I didn't date anybody outside of my race until I got married. I married a white guy, a white man, when I was in my early 30s. He was the first white person I had ever kissed or gone on a date with. It never even occurred to me to date outside my race before that. It wasn't a challenge so much as I had to adjust constantly my ideals about what my relationship was going to look like. I'd always thought that I'd end up with a black man with black children, and that we live in a black, you know, kind of micro society of our friends. And there would be no code switching. You know, this would be, I could be who I was with these people, and that would be it.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Laura, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of your show.
Well, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually found out about your work when it rolled through my Instagram newsfeed because my friend Rima Zaman shared an article titled White Women, I'm Glad You're Showing Up, But I'm Not Sure I Trust You Just Yet. And the title alone struck me so much because I related it to it on so many levels, because when I've had white people complain to me about certain things, that you kind of realize, like, well, this isn't really a problem for you as much as, you know, you're making your problem my problem, which was really strange. But before we get into all that, I want to start by asking, where in the world did you grow up, and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the life, on your life trajectory and the choices that you've made with your career?
Thank you for that question. I grew up entirely in the United States, born in Chicago, left when I was 4. Lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts until high school aged. Then I lived in Berkeley through high school. And I did a brief stint in Florida, where my father has lived since I was 4, in Fort Lauderdale. And then I've been in Los Angeles since 1988.
Yeah.
And so my parents were hippies. They were had a very diverse, eclectic, kind of intellectual, artistic group of friends of all races. And I grew up in a very diverse environment, but skewing mainly black, but there were always all kinds of people around. However, in school, because I went to independent schools in Cambridge, so the years before high school, I was the only black kid in my whole school for a while. And then there were a couple more that came in lower grades. So I was just the only black kid in my class. And that was, you know, that was all right. It wasn't terrible. No one's dating yet by that in those years.
Yeah.
I think that's when it really becomes a problem, when people start selecting people to be with, to date, to, you know, to court. And that's when the lack of diversity would have been a problem for me. But at that age, I was just kind of part of, but I was always different then at the same time. So I learned at a very early age to adapt and adjust, to code switch, which is something that people talk about a lot. Like, I could speak with all my white friends one way, speak at home another way, with my black cousins another way.
Wow. Okay. So that alone right there, you know, raises so many different questions, as you might imagine. It's funny that you observed, like when people start dating people is the moment that you became much more aware of how you're different. Because I grew up as one of like a handful of Indian kids in a small Texas town, where I had the exact same experience where, you know, third through about seventh grade, it didn't really matter. And then suddenly you just start to feel really self-conscious about your race in a way that you never did before. But before we get into that, you know, in your parents' generation, you know, I mean, it sounds like they've raised you with sort of this very diverse environment. What did they teach you about race growing up?
You know, I had this incident once where we were at an amusement park, some kids from my neighborhood and I, we were all black, and this was in Boston. And we were there by ourselves, I guess. I don't remember an adult being with us. I was about 10 years old. And the gentleman that was like the ride operator after we went on the roller coaster for the third time said, "Oh, it must be Watermelon Day. Look at all these little N-words here." Mm. And the kids in my group were furious. And one of them actually tried to fight him, which was the most traumatic thing for me because I had never seen anybody fight, let alone a little kid trying to fight an adult. So when I got home, I asked my mom why everybody was so angry. I had no idea that watermelon was something that would be, you know, said derogatorily toward me. And I didn't know what the N-word was. I'd never heard it. That was the first conversation I ever remember having about race. My mother was shaking. She was so furious. And what I know now is that both my parents grew up in Jim Crow. They were both abused and beaten and by the nuns in the Catholic schools that they went to for being Black, period. So wow. They had terrible racist experiences growing up. You know, both my parents are Black. And so they had really done their best to protect me from that. And up until that moment, they had been successful.
Yeah. So, like, for you, what impact did that have on your own sort of way of socializing in the world? I mean, to have heard that from your parents, to have had that experience, you know, because that, I think even, you know, we're talking, you and I were just mentioning Isabel Wilkerson's book, Caste, and The interesting thing that she mentioned to me is how, you know, we have almost these subconscious stereotypes of Black people, all of us.
Yeah.
And it just really struck me, like, we have these subconscious biases, even, you know, and she quotes a sociologist and he says, you know, what kind of person would say that, you know, say, think these kinds of things. He was like, your closest friends, You know, people who are kind, people who are anything but racist, but they still have the bias.
Right.
And so I wonder, when you had that experience, what kinds of decisions did it make about how you would go about, you know, making your way in the world and interacting with people, particularly people of different race?
Well, let me just back up a little bit because really, I just remember the first conversation my parents had with me about race, because I mentioned that my parents were divorced when I was little. I used to fly by myself back and forth, starting at age 5, from Boston to Florida to see my dad. And, you know, there were obviously no cell phones then. I was a really little kid traveling alone. So the advice my parents gave me is if I got in trouble, if I got lost, look for a sister. And a sister is a Black woman, not a nun. And I would, so that was said to me that if I needed to be safe, I needed to find somebody that looked like me. So that was actually, I mean, it was good advice for me. Everybody that I found was very nice. Every time I got in trouble, I searched for a Black woman. And she got me where I needed to go. Yeah. So that was really the base for how I operated. I didn't feel unsafe necessarily, but if I needed to feel safe, I would find Black people to feel safe with. What my mother told me that day that I came home from the amusement park was that this was something that people say when they hate Black people. And it had never occurred to me that anybody would hate anybody that they didn't know. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I there were people that I hated, I'm putting that in air quotes, at my school because they were mean or they didn't like me or whatever, but I knew them. I would never have not liked them or hated them just because of what they look like. So that definitely impacted the way I walked into rooms from then on. That you know, that kind of talisman or instruction I had to look for a sister was much more enforced. So when I walked into rooms where there were no Black people, I did not feel as safe from that point forward. Wow. And, you know, the way that I was raised, I told you, was very diverse. School was not, but socially it was pretty diverse. So I didn't really have that issue until I got into high school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, I kind of wonder, you know, how that influences your friendships, because I know, you know, you have another article on you know, HuffPost titled "I Have a White Boyfriend, Does That Make Me Any Less Black?"
Yeah.
So that's such an interesting contrast to say, okay, you know what, the paradox there is strange to me, because you're like, you know, you're taught that to feel unsafe around people who are not Black, and yet you have a white boyfriend. How does that play out in your relationship?
Well, I didn't date anybody outside of my race until I got married. I married a white guy, a white man, who, when I was in my early 30s, he was the first white person I had ever kissed or gone on a date with. It never even occurred to me to date outside my race before that. And it was definitely, what's the word I want to look for? It wasn't a challenge so much as I had to adjust constantly my ideals about what my relationship was going to look like. I'd always thought that I'd end up with a black man with black children, and that we live in a black, you know, kind of micro society of our friends, and there would be no code switching. You know, this would be, I could be who I was with these people, and that would be it. And, so I fell in love with a white man. He and I had two kids. We got divorced. And then I fell in love with another white man, the one that I'm with currently. And, you know, it's a lot of negotiating with myself, about my identity, because my identity as a black woman feels threatened when I'm not with another black person. And I don't even know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no,
why I wrote that article, you know?
So, you know, the thing that, you know, you've alluded to code switching twice now, you know, mm-hmm. the thing that reminds me of is, you know, I always tell my roommates, I was like, look, if I date or marry an Indian girl and she comes home, there are all these sort of code switching things that don't have to happen. You know, the example I'll give you is this. So, you know, no matter how long you've been dating an Indian girl, it could be a year and you could be having all the sex in the world at your apartment. You bring that girl home for the first time, she sleeps in a separate room.
Right.
At your parents' house.
Right.
And it's understood. You know, my brother-in-law jokes that his mom thought that he was sleeping on the couch and my sister was sleeping in the bed even after they started living together. and, you know, so what I wonder is how that works, because I'll often hear this, you know, I've heard some version of this from black people where if they're like dating a white, you know, person, they mm-hmm. get some sort of criticism of, a, you know, being a sellout, or, you yeah. know, if you're like a brown guy dating, you know, a white girl, they call you Oreo, you know, these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So how does the, like, what happens in terms of response, like your parents, your relatives, and your black friends when they see this, you know, and how does the code switching actually happen? And for the people who don't understand what code switching is, can you explain it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best way to explain it with regard to me is that I would say and do things around my black friends that I wouldn't around my white friends. There's a different lexicon that I yeah. could and did use with them, only mainly because I would be a lot of explaining myself if I said the same things to my black friends that I do to my white friends. Be like, what do you mean by that? I don't understand. So I just switch it up and say something that they will understand instead of saying it the way that I would normally say it to my black friends.
Yeah.
But sometimes code switching, of course, can be speaking another language. Like someone who is Spanish speaking can switch it up and break into Spanish when you don't even know that they speak Spanish, right? And that kind of thing is more common, but that is also code switching, what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And now, I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, as far as, you know, sort of having grown up, you know, with two black parents, having this sort of, you know, micro community of largely black people.
Yeah.
When you go and marry a white person, you know, how does that impact right. the dynamics that right. you have with your friends and family?
Certainly my brothers, I have five brothers. And they are all younger than me. They're all like 6'4", 6'5". They're formidable, these guys. And two of them had never spent any time with white people. So and they don't live here. So they live in other parts of the country. But when I brought them all here to, not just to meet Scott, but, you know, for a gathering and Scott was there, it was obvious they had no idea how to act around him. It was really awkward. It was like I brought a gazelle into the living room.
Yeah.
And they were all like they froze. And they were speaking like, yeah, I don't know. It was just so weird. It was so awkward. But then, you know, now like my dad and my brothers, my mom always loved Scott. She loved him from the beginning. My friends, there wasn't any problem with him. There was a little bit of a couple of them were incredulous that this was going to work because I had been known to them as someone who preferred Black people. That's how they thought of me. So I think they thought that my relationship with the first white man and then even the second was going to be a flash in the pan and that I would go back to Black people. But once they decided that this was a good thing for me, they were all on board, including my brothers, including my father.
Yeah. What is it like for you know, from the side of your husband, like his experience of this?
You mean, for
boyfriend,
Scott?
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
for your boyfriend, yeah.
It was a challenge for him too. You know, there were just, you know, I wrote in that article, he's really white. You know, my ex-husband is white, but he's very much like steeped in hip hop culture.
Okay.
And not in a wannabe way at all. He grew up in Brooklyn around it, made a career out of, you know, film and music of that genre. He just really loves it. He has a lot of Black friends. And so we shared the same culture almost, even though he was white. Scott and I don't share a culture at all. You know, he grew up listening to Dave Matthews and alternative music. And it was, I had never heard of the Dave Matthews Band until he and I dated. And he was just stunned by that. Like, what? And I didn't particularly care for the music that he likes. Like, I'm a straight up hip hop head, which is, you know, kind of silly, but that's the music I grew up on in the 80s hip hop all the way through. That's what I knew. So
you mean before white people and boy bands ruined it?
Yes.
You know, like I always say, it was like Boys to Men. You remember those old school hip hop? And then suddenly you got, you know, boy bands and it was just like, ah, man, this is crap.
You're taking it over. But so yeah, Scott and I don't share a culture. And in addition to that, he's an outdoors guy and I'm a city mouse. Like, I don't want to be outside any longer than I have to unless I'm playing tennis, honestly, or by the pool. I like that too. But I'm not going hiking. I'm certainly not going mountain biking or, you know, any of the stuff that he loves to do was really foreign to me. So the culture shock was the hardest thing.
I can relate. It's funny because, you know, my roommates go hiking and it's funny. I'm like this anomaly for an Indian person. I'm an avid surfer and a snowboarder, which are both predominantly white sports.
Yeah.
Anytime they invite me to go hiking, I'm like, no, dude, brown people don't hike. Have you ever seen an Indian person in a Patagonia ad? There's a reason for that. But, you know, it turns out they do. It like they said, you know, they came back once. They're like, hey, we just came back and there were a gaggle of Indians hiking with
a gaggle.
It was like, yeah, you found that the rare. Well, I mean, so much so that, you know, I remember my, you know, grandmother's, you know, one of my cousins, he would go visit his grandmother and, you know, we would tell our parents, it's like, you know, we don't do anything when we go to India. We just sit around and like eat, you know, food and gossip. And like our friends, like they go hiking in the Himalayas and our parents would say some version of, well, that shit is for white people, not for us.
Right. You
know, well, it's never like camping or hiking or any of that stuff. Indian people never did that.
Bundling up on the beach. Like, why? Go to a tropical one.
Well, it's funny because the comedian Carlos Mencia said, he's like, you know, white people go camping. He was like, for people who are minorities, that's voluntarily living in poverty.
Right. We're not attracted to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are some exceptions. The world that I grew up in, that was not a thing. And it's still not a thing for me, you know?
I think it also, you know, I want to come back to this in a second because it really brings about a lot of conversation about stereotypes. But I want to ask one other thing about your children, you know, who grow up mixed race.
Yes.
Like for them, what is racism like to, and when they're out with their dad versus being out with you, is the experience different?
I'm sure it is. So my kids are 20 and 22 and they are both boys. They are biracial, yes, but they present Black. And I'm not going to say I think that's easier. I think when you're racially ambiguous, there's an extra layer to how you're perceived by the world.
Yeah.
So for them, there's no identity question when they go out. They are identified as Black easily. Brian, my ex, and I did our absolute best to raise them in as a diverse environment as possible, giving them, Brian's Jewish, so giving them their Jewish heritage, giving them their Black culture and heritage. We cherry-picked schools for them where there was absolutely the most diversity while giving them, you know, the best education. So I think my kids grew up a little like I did, you know, not race is, was not their first identity when they walked into school. It was their basketball capabilities. It was how they did on, you know, the PSAT. It was what girls, you know, they were talking to. Like those were the primary things by which they were identified and not by race, even though I know that was factored in. It wasn't the first thing. And so they were never really, you know, there was an incident once where someone posted a picture of my son on Instagram when he was 11 and it had the N-word in it, a white kid. And I went off and the school suspended this kid and I yelled at the mother and she brought the son over to me. And I was just so furious, but my kid was kind of like, Mom, we all say it. It's not a big deal. Like, wow. It doesn't mean the same thing to me that it means to you. And although I accepted him saying that, I was still furious because to me, it's always off limits, no matter what. No. But their experience of race is much, much different. They didn't and don't feel the need to protect themselves the same way that I learned to, you know, like high school age and up.
Well, I think that makes sort of a perfect segue to talking about stereotypes. You know, like I remember, so I had two Black roommates, one of who is still a good friend to this day. And we went there and, you know, I remember going to meet them. And, you know, I asked this question with my friends, like, you realize how racist that sounds, right? And I was like, you guys smoke weed, right? Not because they were Black, but because I wanted to make sure that I was living with people who smoke weed, because I do. You know? But I kind of also realized that subconsciously, I probably did just assume that.
Right.
So, you know, as a Black woman in America, what are the stereotypes that you have to overcome? And what do you think are the differences between the stereotypes that Black men have to deal with versus Black women?
Oh, gosh. They're so different. So I think my stereotypes, because of how I am, because of how I was raised and how I present, are that there's a more of a fetishizing of me, where I am the token, I am the acceptable Black friend, I'm not threatening, I'm the example. And usually, you know, either the only one or one of two or three in whatever situation I'm in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my racism toward me, and racism to me is anytime anybody treats anybody differently because of their race. To me, that's racism. Bigotry is something totally different, where that is, you know, mean-spirited bullying, hate speech. Like that's bigotry to me. So I don't have very many bigoted people in my life, if any. But I do have a lot of racist people that do treat me differently because I'm Black. And that goes from, you know, being surprised that, you know, about how articulate I am. And saying it to me as though it's a compliment when it's really a microaggression, you know, to notice that out loud to me. Notice it to yourself. Oh, that's fine. But don't say it out loud to me as though I'm going to say thank you. Because it's a microaggression, like I said, you know, talking, I could do a whole podcast for you about white women and my hair. You know, my hair is fetishized by white women all the time, to the point where I've had people cross the room to put their fingers in it, because I wear my hair natural. It's curly. Like right now it's actually in braids, but when it's not in braids, I wear it natural and curly. And it has just become this source of fascination with white women simply because it's different than theirs, but it's also different than I think a lot of Black hair used to be. And so there'll be questions that are honestly rude about my hair that they don't seem to think anything of asking me, like, how do you get it like that? What do you do to it to get it to stand up? Is your hair nappy or is it curly? I don't know the difference.
Wow. You could probably do a movie with all these things.
Oh, well, movies have been done for sure. So those are some of the things that I get. I think for Black men, like when I said the first thing that I mentioned before about me being fetishized is because I'm not threatening, I think almost everyone's threatened by Black men. And so there's a fear factor that comes in the room as they do. And, you know, it is the scariest thing for me because I know that when my kids get pulled over by the police, that policeman's probably scared of them. So everything that they do, every movement they make is going to be spotlighted or highlighted because there's a fear factor. And I'm not saying the policemen are wrong for being afraid. That's just how they are. But probably my kid is going to be, I was just watching this Driving While Black thing on TV and how many 5 times more likely, 4 times more likely in any part of the country that you go to, Black people are that times more likely to be pulled over by the police than white drivers. So when we're pulled over, when Black men are pulled over, because they're seen as threatening, you know, my kid reaching for his registration in the glove box could end up like so many others that we've seen on TV if he's not narrating, if he's not moving slowly enough. So the policeman's scared. My kid's probably scared, right? They're getting pulled over. They understand what the situation here is in America. They might do something stupid because they're afraid. So it is really, really scary, the things that Black men have to endure and go through. And we talked about systemically in this country, because they are seen as threatening, is terrifying. You know, I don't sleep well when both my kids aren't home. Period.
I remember going through when we were talking about Isabel's book Cast, and she was talking about how media portrays and stereotypes Black people, and so that there are two questions that come from this for me. One of them is about the police thing, but there's another question. I can't remember the damn name of the movie. It's with Tommy Davidson, and he's trying to rise up through the mailroom to become this hotshot ad exec. And he has a, I think it's Boomerang is the Eddie Murphy one.
Right. I know which one you're talking about.
Basically it's him, not Damon Wayans. The guy's name is Wayman Tisdale. I remember that, the character's name. And one of the things that he, the guy who's trying to write the Tommy Davidson character is constantly making fun of this, Wayman character for being a Black guy who's too white because of the fact that he is, articulate and like all this other stuff, like he makes fun of him. And I'm wondering, is that with this whole code switching thing, is that something that you ever experience when you're around your Black friends and they see you? Because you've talked about presenting as, you use that phrase multiple times.
I don't know. Not around my friends. Okay. Most of my friends are like me.
Yeah.
So we're kind of cut from the same cloth, but certainly when I lived in Florida for the years that I lived there, I was taking classes at a local community college. And, I don't know if there's this book called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria?
On my list of things to order on Amazon, it keeps showing up.
Yeah. It's a really great study in why that happens. But basically it's that thing that my parents taught me when I was little, it's just safe, right? So I would go to where the Black kids gathered, to those tables, whatever those look like. And boy, I mean, first of all, the language that was used, it was almost like the people that lived there spoke a different language than I did. I was always saying, sorry, pardon? I didn't get that. It was a totally different lexicon. It's slang. It was, it was hood slang, but for that dialect was for that particular area of South Florida. And they were not having me someone, you know who it was? This is jumping ahead. This is later on. Toni Braxton, who's a really beautiful singer. Our kids went to school together. And we were soccer moms together. And I came up to her once when on the, you know, the bleachers and the bench. And she didn't see me until I got next to her. And she's like, girl, you were throwing out Caucasian vibes all the way over here. I didn't even know you were a sister. You need to throw out some sister vibes and you approach me next time. And this is how I was treated by that crowd in Florida. They were not, I was throwing out Caucasian vibes to them. They were not having me. And I tried, I was a source of curiosity, but I was never allowed in. Like I could never have been part of them because I did not grow up the way they did. I did not speak the way they did. I didn't understand things the same way. I was distrusted because of that.
Yeah. Wow. The other thing that, you know, you were talking about, you know, being pulled over by police, particularly, you know, Black men are much more likely to be pulled over. The thing that struck me when I was reading Isabel Wilkerson's book is she said, you know, what we don't do in the media is she said, we actually don't tell the other stories of white people who actually apparently, she said, we just tend to amplify stories of Black people far more in media than we do white people. And she said, if you actually look at the numbers, I don't remember the exact statistics, but when I saw that, I was like, wow. So even the media is guilty of perpetuating stereotypes that are negative of Black people.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think I was wondering about that too. Like we're seeing Black men after Black men getting shot by the police. And I wonder, are they just not showing white men that get shot by the police or is it not happening? Or white women? There aren't, you know, it's disproportionate for men, as you know, what we're seeing are Breonna Taylor, which is a tragic, tragic case, but it was kind of a fluke. They weren't coming for her, you know? They didn't even know she was there. They were coming for a Black man. And it's really Black men disproportionately that are getting shot. But I don't know how, I don't know why that is and what it looks like, but I do know that statistically, we are more likely to get pulled over in the first place. So that's not the media. That's just the data, you know, that they're, like I said, we are more of a threat on site. So, you know, we're profiled.
So, you know what? I want to ask, you know, what role sort of environment and context play? And I'll give you sort of context to, you know, frame this question. To this day, I can never forget the experience of this friend that I grew up with. I remember spending the night at his house in seventh grade, and his mom would, you know, use the N-word gratuitously. And we're not talking like, you know, and this was, you know, small Texas town, but his parents weren't sort of, you know, ignorant, uneducated rednecks. They were PhDs, you know, from like one of the wealthiest families in town. But the day that I never forgot, when I was in ninth grade, two Black kids got in a fight at school. One stabbed the other, and one of them died. And so we were all sent home from school, and my dad, you know, was a postdoc, so he couldn't pick me up. And he said, okay, go home with David's mom. And, you know, she used the N-word, and she said, now that you know, N-word got, you know, killed, you can go get your hair cut. And she drove us to the country club to go and have lunch, where we were served lunch by a Black waiter. And if you're a minority, it's very hard to shake. And yet, you know, I was accepted freely, because the stereotype of Indians is like, we're kind of the model minority. And, you know, even the 7-Eleven stereotype, like if people don't know, it's like, the 7-Eleven guy owns 20 of them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But then this same friend actually grew up to become a police officer, which to me was so horrifying to think that, you know, this is the kind of racism that was just reinforced in his household. And it, you know, again, these were actually very nice people to me.
Right.
Beyond that thing. So, you know, what role do environment, context, you know, and parents play? And you know, I guess that takes us to here we are. That was 30 plus years ago and we're still having the same conversation.
Yeah. Well, first of all, that is definitely a good example of bigotry. That's not just racism, what you're describing in that family. And so the mother was a bigot and not just a racist. I wrote an article called White Parents Teach Your Kids About Racism. My 11-year-old was called the N-word, White Parents Teach Your Kids About Racism. That's also in HuffPo. And, you know, I think that especially now, you know, it's, I had a talk with another podcaster about this. It's the best way to provide the best foundation for your child to go out and be a global citizen is not just by talking to them about race and that kind of, and other, it's not just race, you know, there's culture, there's heritage, there's religion, about diversity of any kind, socioeconomic, but by showing them by the people that you have in your home, the people that you fraternize with, right? So if that Black person in their lives was at their dinner table instead of serving them dinner, then that your friend would have learned something else about Black people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Seeing them as included. If you have all white friends, all white dinner tables, then you're probably going to raise a child that is not fully prepared to be, like I said, a global citizen, because they won't have had the interactions with people at that level to know how to interact with them.
Yeah.
And then you have bias. And you know, like you said at the beginning, I don't know if this is when we're recording, but everybody has bias. Everybody. But some people are more biased, and some people's biases have, you know, like they're tinged with bigotry, or they are bigoted. And so then you have another layer of this that becomes really harmful and potentially deadly.
Mm. Well, I think that's it's an interesting place to bring us full circle to where we started, which was your article titled "White Women, I'm, you know, mm-hmm. glad you're showing up, but not sure I trust you just yet." And I think that, you know, the conclusion of that article, when I read that, that was when I immediately contacted Rima and said, "Hey, can you introduce Laura? Because I want to talk to her about this." You said, you know, white women, I'm not saying that you can't be scared, outraged, or sad. I'm not saying that we don't appreciate you and your efforts to connect. I understand that you've lost something too, and I want you to feel your sorrow and indignation. But please know that your grief doesn't automatically entitle you to an invitation to our wake. Many conversations need to be happening right now, but some of those can only occur between people of color. Mm-hmm. That struck me so much because I thought, it, you know, like I said, I related to it when I said, you know, like when a white person comes to me to complain about something in my own work that lacks diversity, I'm kind of like, the example I'll give you, you know, for example, I remember, you know, I did a TEDx talk. And so I found these stock images and, you know, I gave the talk and the speakers bureau was run entirely by white people, came back and they said, the talk was great. There's only one problem. What's that? All the, you know, kids in the slides were white. I was like, well, doesn't the fact that an Indian guy is giving the talk kind of compensate for look, I didn't notice that. It didn't even occur to me.
Right.
You know, right. Which yeah. I think that's a sort of perfect parallel to what you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is, what do you want white people listening to this to know?
Oh, boy.
is that like another hour conversation?
Yeah. You know, I would say that this particular time in history, where we are right now, circa 2020, starting, like I said, like I mentioned before, with the death of Breonna Taylor and all the deaths that have occurred, the high profile deaths of Black people that have occurred since then, have really wounded us culturally, Black people in particular. And I think what's happening is there's this phenomenon of a lot of white people, especially women, which is why I wrote that article, waking up and seeing this for the first time and starting to get motivated or excited not in like, I'm glad this happened, but can you believe this is happening kind of way. And so they're coming to this with this fervor and this excitement about this is terrible and we should do something. And we're all like, y'all are late. Like we've been saying this since, you know, my grandparents or my great grandparents and my great, you know, like on and on and on. We've been talking about this. We've never stopped talking about it. And I get that you're excited about it right now, but y'all need to chill because we are so wounded. And I'm glad you want to get activated and I'm glad you want to start, but don't come to me to tell me things about racism right now that you've just discovered. Don't do that. Tell it to your other white friends, educate each other, bring up the level of consciousness in this country, please. But don't come to me all like jazzed or motivated to do something about something that has been happening to me my entire life and generations before me, as if it's the first time that it's happened. Hmm. So that's what I think I want to say.
Yeah. So when something is so deeply woven and embedded into systems and structures that have put in place to create the context that we're living in, you know, how do you get out of this? I mean, are we, because it doesn't seem like you're going to rewrite 200 years of history by electing a new president.
No. Gosh, wouldn't that
regardless
be nice?
How tolerant that person is. I mean, even with Obama, you didn't get that to happen.
Right, right. Yeah, man, 8 years of him was, well, I won't get too much into politics.
Yeah.
But I do love that man. I think here's the good news is that post George Floyd's death, more policies and laws were changed in favor of Black people and, away from the way things were done, which was racist in many, many states, towns, cities. More policies were changed and by law in 7 weeks than had been done in 400 years. Like,
wow.
Not really. It was actually in 7 years, but it was so more policies were changed in 7 weeks post George Floyd than had been changed in 7 years in favor of Black people and people of color, not just Black people. So there is a movement which I fear is faltering, because so much spotlight is on our current situation with the election. But there is movement toward changing the policies that need to be changed in order to create equity. You know, which is different than equality, right? And I don't know if people really understand the difference. I'm probably not going to explain it well, but equity is really just giving everybody the same chance, not making sure that everybody has the same thing, which is equality, right? But just that everybody has the same chance. And to be able to do that, policies and laws need to change, so that Black people have the same chance as everybody else. And it's not a handout, and it's not, but it is change, and people are going to fight it because no one likes change anyway. Change is always scary. But like I said, it is changing, so I am hopeful. And I'm going to do whatever I can personally to see it continue.
Hmm. Wow. Wow. Well, this has been really, really incredible. I've just enjoyed talking to you so much. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
To make somebody unmistakable. Ooh. I mean, I think that someone has had to have gone through and been aware and present during all the changes and experiences of their life and taken from them what they need to take from them instead of ignoring them or instead of numbing them, and really stayed present for these things to bring it. Like, if you can't use your, like, I don't think opinions are very valid personally. The thing that I put the most stock in is someone's experience. Someone wants to give me advice, I'm really not here for it. But if someone wants to tell me their experience with something that I'm going through or about to go through, I'm all ears. And so I think that we value all these different things, in the material realm, in the intellectual realm, the academic realm. But really the thing that is of the utmost value is our experience. And so I think that's the answer to that question.
Beautiful. I think that may be the most distinctive answer I've heard in a long time.
Great. Awesome.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your stories and your wisdom and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking that. And I'm going to tell you, but first I just really have to double shout out Rima Zaman for connecting us. I'm so grateful to her. This is amazing. So thank you for that opportunity. And thank you, Rima, if you're listening, for the connection. You're the best. I have my podcast, The Only One in the Room, has a website, which is theonlyonepod.com. My Instagram is Laura Cathcart Robbins, at Laura Cathcart Robbins. It's LauraCathcartRobbins. On Twitter, I'm at Laura C. Robbins. I'm on LinkedIn, Laura Cathcart Robbins, and Facebook, Laura Cathcart Robbins.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.